Is America going the way of the Roman Empire? A growing number of Christians think so, and I'm one of them.
Rod Dreher talking about his presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That's why I say that Christians today should take a new look at the way the early Benedictine monks, who emerged out of the ruins of Rome, responded to the collapse of their civilization. We can learn from them how to build stable lives of prayer, Bible study, and worship in strong communities. The Benedict option, as I call it, is not about running away from the world. It's about learning the practices of discipleship that enable us to stand firm for Christ against the world for the sake of the world.
You can meet and hear Rod Dreher making the case for the Benedict option at the Fall Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120. Child care is free. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Every leap of civilization was built off the back of slaves. Replicants are the future, but I can only make so many. I had the lock, and he has the key. I think I found him.
That's not possible. If this gets out, we've bought ourselves a war.
You're a cop. I had your job once.
Things were simpler then.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions. What happened?
I covered my tracks. Scrambled the records.
We were being hunted.
By who?
They know you're here.
You do not know what pain is yet. You will learn. Bring it to me.
That is the trailer of the movie Blade Runner 2049. It is a follow-up to, well, a movie that if you are a sci-fi fan, you know it. You know it because you've seen it probably 100 times, and then you've seen its influence in science fiction films over and over and over again. Although, I think when it first opened at the box office, it wasn't much of a hit, and it doesn't sound like Blade Runner 2049 is that much of a hit, but you never know. Those cult classics come about, well, it's not always the box office. We'll be reviewing that movie on this Friday afternoon, October the 13th. Pastor Ted Giese joins us. He has a bachelor's degree in fine arts, pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity and the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
First of all, we got to warn the audience that to do a good and thorough review of the movie, we're going to have to issue some spoiler alerts. There will be spoilers. So if you are a big fan of this movie, want to see this movie, then wait until after you've seen it, and then you can listen to this review. What made the first one, Blade Runner, what made it such a cult classic?
Yeah, it became a cult classic. When it came originally in the theaters in 1982, it wasn't super popular at the theaters, but it became popular actually through VHS, like through the video rental kind of world. So it had some things going for it. It had Harrison Ford in it as the lead character, Rick Deckard, and people loved Harrison Ford because of both Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And those are genre pictures or series, and this is a sci-fi film, so it kind of fit very well in that. So it had that going for it. It also became a cult classic film because of the style of it. There's kind of in the review that I wrote, I say there's kind of like before Blade Runner and after Blade Runner for science fiction films. It's kind of one of these watershed films in the same way that Star Wars was a big watershed film for sci-fi. This one goes back into referencing things like Fritz Lang's silent film Metropolis. It's a German expressionist silent film, which was one of the very first sci-fi movies that showed like this kind of like really overgrown cityscape. And Blade Runner tapped into that visual kind of cue from there. It also had all these film noir beats in it that, you know, the people were familiar with from like old Humphrey Bogart movies and things like that. So you had like the detective. It was dealing with a bunch of things that people were familiar with, but had never seen all together the way that it was put together. And Ridley Scott then also, who had been in advertising previously as he was becoming a film director, he was, you know, involved in things like, you know, the ad for Apple and stuff like that at the Olympics, like these kinds of atmospheric kind of things, if I remember correctly. So he put together this world where the movie itself was more about being immersed in a futuristic world than it wasn't quickly speeding from one thing to the next thing. It would settle on moments so that you had a chance to feel like you were a part of it. It's also one of these first big dystopic films that kind of present a future that's grim and unsure. And then it has robots and a little bit of action and stuff like that in it. So all of that kind of wraps up together to make it a very, you know, satisfying film. And then also along the way, it really became a cult film because people knew that the film that they were watching wasn't the one that he wanted to present to people. So it had these kind of schmaltzy voiceovers and stuff that Harrison Ford is like listlessly going through. So eventually Ridley Scott was able to present the film the way he wanted to. So there was the director's cut and then finally the final cut, and he got the film to where he wanted it to be. So it became kind of like a holy grail to like to know and see the film the way he wanted it to be. And that also adds to its cult classic, you know, prestige.
So plot-wise, what are we talking about in terms of the first, and where does the second one, Blade Runner 2049, pick up?
The first one is based on this short, well, it's a novella by Philip K. Dick, and it's all about androids and human nature. So Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is the name of the book. The novella came out in 1968. So what happened in the theatrical rendering of that, re-envisioning of it that Ridley Scott gave, was this this story about these replicants, these androids that are actually prohibited on Earth. And if any of them end up on Earth, they're made for off-world labor, for slave labor force. If any of them end up on Earth or they're found on Earth, then the police send out like a para police sort of detective to go find them and retire, quote unquote, retire them. And those guys are called Blade Runners. So in the first film, Harrison Ford is the Blade Runner who is sent to find this group of mercenary renegade androids that have come back to Earth from off world and to find them and retire them. And as it unfolds, he then meets another android who doesn't know that she's an android, named Rachel. And by the end of it, they've fallen in love and they've run off together. And there's some question as to his own humanity in it or lack of humanity in it. Is he a replicant himself? Is he an android himself? Is it possible? And that's kind of the generally what happened by the end of it. He and her ran away. The new one picks up years later, and a mystery is unfolding. There is a Blade Runner who is actually a replicant, and they let you know that right off the beginning. His name is Kay, and he's played by Ryan Gosling. So then he's searching down, based on a tip, these renegade androids, and as that's going on, then he stumbles upon a real mystery. In the middle of all of it, he has an interaction with a protein farmer, a guy who's like growing grubs for people to eat because the world is a pretty crappy place by that point in 2049. And the guy who he's having this conversation with, this other replicant, says that the reason that he can do his job, like a replicant coming to kill other replicants, is because he, Kay, the main character, hasn't seen a miracle. And the miracle is, turns out, again, spoilers, the miracle turns out to be that Rachel from the first movie conceived with Deckard and had a pregnancy that produced a child, which robots shouldn't do. So this is the miracle that then drives the rest of the story.
Now, does it struggle with the same kind of things as the first film? Does it take up new issues to struggle with?
I think it continues that struggle. So there's this, you know for sure that Kay is a replicant from the beginning of the film, that is clear. So he's dealing with things like loneliness and whether he should obey everything he's supposed to obey. How does he do his work? He's dealing with love. He's got this kind of peculiar relationship with an artificial intelligence called Joy that is kind of a generic one that you can purchase, and lots of people probably have it, and it's like a built-in girlfriend kind of thing. So he's like, you've got that kind of like, what does it mean to be a human? What does it mean to have a soul? At one point, he's asked to, you know, find this child and retire it. And he comments, he says, you know, like, I've never retired anything that was born. To be born means to have a soul. And then his superior officer along the way also just kind of says, well, you know, you've gotten by okay without a soul. You don't really need a soul for this job. Go do your work. So he's struggling with all of that. So these questions are a part of this film too. And they're kind of actually, they get into this other kind of movement that exists outside of the movie that movies like this delve into called transhumanism. And there are scientists and people, theorists, philosophers that are thinking about all this stuff right now. Like, what is the interaction between the biological and the synthetic? Can something synthetic have a soul? How does that work? Can you transfer your soul into something synthetic? This sounds really out there sci-fi stuff, but there are people who are thinking about all this stuff. They're talking about it. They're, you know, envisioning a world where you, you know, digitally put yourself into the cloud and then you can, you know, have, you know, jailbreak or hack immortality. So this is stuff that is going on in the world that they're thinking about and theorizing and researching. And you see some of that stuff in this film itself. And it makes it kind of an interesting film to think about these things connected to.
We're reviewing the movie Blade Runner 2049. Pastor Ted Giese is our guest on this Friday afternoon, October the 13th. When we come back, who is the villain in this film and why does he make so many allusions to the Bible?
And we're gonna have a ball just like we always do. Saturday night at the movies. Who cares what picture you see?
If you plan to buy one item commemorating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, I highly recommend the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. It's titled The Reformation. You'll want to display this richly illustrated book on your coffee table, in your church library, or anywhere you can easily flip through this informative and beautiful book. The Reformation is written by regular guest Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Learn more about The Reformation at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Synod and wondered why more people from your congregation aren't there? Then check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so your circuit can prepare, promote, and present a seminar that will appeal to all the members of your congregation, provided for free by the CLCC. Just go to theclcc.org. theclcc.org and click on the blue box or check us out on Facebook.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, reviewing the new movie Blade Runner 2049. Pastor Ted Giese is our guest. He taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity in the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. Talk a little bit about the villain in this film and his many allusions to Holy Scripture.
Yeah, the character is Neander Wallace, and he's an industrialist. He has purchased the Tyrell Corporation, which from the first film was the corporation that, you know, this guy Tyrell was the guy who came up with these replicants, and the company failed at one point. He purchased the company and he's now running this company, and he has managed to have the prohibition on androids lifted because he's made them in such a way that they obey, that they don't get off the rails. And yeah, he is this kind of character, and I mentioned in the review that he's one of these villains who's both at odds with God, and yet he ends up being like pretty much the only character that regularly quotes scripture and makes these biblical allusions. So he fancies and fashions himself after being like God. Like he looks at all of these replicants that obey perfectly, and he looks at them like, these are my angels. He refers to them as angels. And then he talks about the ones that had rebelled in the past, and he refers to them as fallen angels. And he talks about, you know, being able to, hopefully by his work, being able to storm the gates of Eden. So there's this kind of thing where he's looking at himself as a god, but he's also not a believer in the actual God, or he has an antagonistic relationship to God in it, in his character. He is a villain. There is a point where he ends up having an actual conversation with Harrison Ford's character, Deckard, who returns in this film. And he's talking to him, and it's all very ambiguous again in this film about whether or not Deckard is a replicant or not. But he's talking to him about Rachel and about this child. And he like literally quotes from Genesis chapter 30, God remembered Rachel in her barrenness and opened her womb. So for people who are biblically illiterate, they might just not realize that that's an actual scriptural paraphrase or quote that he's like using. But it just jumps out at you if you've read the book of Genesis. That just hops out at you. So he's making an allusion between the character of Rachel, who's had this miracle baby in the movie, and of course Rachel from scripture, who bore Jacob's son Joseph in the book of Genesis, and who had also been barren previously to God opening her womb. So this is the kind of thing you run into over and over again in the film, and it actually imbues the film with this layer of biblical illusion, which is kind of an interesting thing to find.
The miracle child, so to speak, character, is it being cast in your way of thinking as a kind of Messiah figure?
Well, they do have that as part of the story. So again, this is all in the spoiler category of things. If you've listened this far, it's not going to get any better for you. So essentially, there is a group of replicants, the renegade ones, who have been kind of scattered and hiding, and they're plotting their being freed from slavery. And they look at her, this child of Rachel and Deckard, as being like their Messiah. Like they've got her hidden away. They're going to reveal her at the right time. They're prepared. She's like the polished arrow in their quiver, and that is the way they're looking at her. Also, from a human point of view, because she's the progeny of this miracle birth, does this quote unquote, like, does this question mark spell the end of biological human replication? And does this usher in this other kind of replication that would make humans obsolete in that way? Is she like an antichrist kind of character, like a, you know, the end of humanity? There's a question with that. That gets into those transhumanist ideas again. And then also the character of Wallace wants her because he wants to backwards engineer her to take his obedient angels and give this ability to them, you know, his replicants, so that he could be a god with his perfectly obeying replicant angels spreading through the universe, etc. So there's a lot of people who want that character, like want to find her and have her for themselves for different reasons. And of course she, you know, you're introduced to her before you know who it is. Like there's a reveal later. There's a kind of a twist in it where you kind of go along and you're supposed to think that it's Kay is the son of these two. And then eventually it's discovered that it's this woman who lives in kind of like a bubble, essentially, who works on memories and things like that. producing memories and, you know, like to be put into people and things. So yeah, you there's a bit of a switcheroo later on, like the audience ends up thinking about the other. They've been kind of led down a path of thinking that it's this guy, the main character, and it turns out it's not. It's this lady.
What's the, and here you have to reference that kind of third version of the original film, not the director's cut, but the final cut. What does the image of the unicorn signify in your opinion?
Yeah, so this is interesting. So here you've got Ridley Scott. Now, Ridley Scott, when he first made the film, he didn't have any of this unicorn footage in it. Later, he came out with the director's cut and then the final cut, and it has this unicorn imagery in it. It's like a memory, kind of a vision or something that the character of Deckard is having. Ridley Scott thinks that this is really evidence that Deckard is an android, like that he himself is an android. So that is in the film. Now, Ridley Scott also made a movie called Legend that is about unicorns and other things like that. So it's very reminiscent of that. So in this Blade Runner, the original, you end up with this unicorn stuff, and you also have a character named Gaff, played by Edward James Olmos, who does these little origami paper animals. And one of the last ones he does is this little unicorn, and he puts it out, and that's the way the first film ends, is Deckard picking up the little unicorn and hearing, like remembering something that Gaff had said, where he says, it's too bad she won't live, but then again, who does? And that's a reference to Rachel, it seems, in that original film. And the whole thing is that it's this unicorn is about Deckard. And this is where the new film is kind of, there's this kind of notion where there's a little bit of retconning going on. Like the original story has changed a bit by the way the new story is unfolding now. And other people might not think this, but as I was watching it, and then later as I was reflecting on it, I thought to myself, because the new film is very ambiguous as to whether Deckard is an android or not. So then maybe he's a human and Rachel's the android, and now it's a union of a human and an android that produces a child. You know, that's a possibility. And it's all very murky. So then the question is, well, what is all that stuff about then in the first film? Like, what is that unicorn about? And of course, through history, unicorns have, the idea of them has developed into this illusion, particularly in the Christian church during the Renaissance period, medieval and Renaissance period, that there's this illusion between the idea of the unicorn and Jesus. And it's wrapped up in kind of ideas about the incarnation and purity. And then, but there were also people who thought that unicorns were real animals and that you could capture them and make out of the horn something that would heal sick people or purify water. And then this whole set of movies, these two movies, are in a world that the world is falling apart. The world is not any good. And there's this kind of humanity hanging in the balance, kind of a thing, a sickness of malaise. So I don't know. I was thinking about all of this and I thought to myself, is that unicorn really, if it's not about Deckard, what is it about? And this is my personal take on it, is that maybe that unicorn could be read as being about their child. Now, that's just, you know, my thinking about it at the moment. And the interesting thing about these movies, the previous movie and this movie, is that this is a kind of science fiction that invites thought, that, you know, it invites the audience to think as they're watching it and afterwards. It's not just simply entertainment. It's not just explosions and, you know, splashy kind of stuff. Like it's an invitation to think about what you're looking at.
Finally, you write this. You say, how will Christians react if science fiction appears to become science reality? Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049 are complementary, thought-provoking films that aren't simply there to entertain but pose questions, as you just said. These questions may not be pressing for Christians today, but they are coming. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, because there are these people who are engaged in this transhumanist kind of approach to biological and synthetic, and they're working on things like artificial intelligence, at one point they're going to, you know, there is artificial intelligence now that they've developed where, for instance, you can have like a computer that tells the drivers of ambulances where to space themselves out in the city so that, you know, they're not all bundled up in the same part of town, that they're equally separated from each other and ready to help people in need. So there are these artificial intelligence programs that exist. But what happens when you get to the point where a claim is made where it's so sophisticated that it's hard for people to distinguish between an artificial intelligence and a human intelligence? What happens when that happens and the claim is that this artificial intelligence has a soul and then as a result requires all of the rights and privileges that a human has? What happens then? Now, I personally don't believe that it's possible for that to happen. Like, I don't think that it may appear that way, but I don't think that it's possible for a machine to have a soul. I think that this is absolutely impossible. But what happens for Christians when the claim is made that they do have one? Like, how do we respond to it then? And I think that it's interesting to think about it. We're not currently at this moment there, but that may happen, maybe even in our lifetime, where that claim is being made. So then how do Christians respond to it? There'll be a CTCR document about it, I imagine. But how do we deal with that? Now, this is, here, you want crazy? What happens if, you know, you have this artificial intelligence that is in a body, like one of these replicants, that it is very, very, you know, hard to distinguish, and they show up and they want to become members of your congregation? Like, this is like way out there crazy. But what then? You know, like, this is the kind of stuff that the film, for a pastor watching the film, you start to think, well, where are we going with all of this? Is it even possible that they could get there? And what does all this look like?
Folks, you can read Pastor Ted Giese's review of Blade Runner 2049 at our website, issuesztc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Pastor Ted Giese has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, and he taught a course for Concordia Lutheran Seminary titled Christianity in the Movies, A Lutheran Approach to Media Consumption. Ted, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
On the other side of the break, Pastor Chris Roseborough is our guest. It's This Week in Pop American Christianity. Today we're going to talk about botching the story of David and Goliath.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.